have a story to tell you about 1968. I was 13 years old. I lived in North Jersey, where it was wealthy, liberal, highly educated. Only we were on the other end of the wealthy part. I was the kid who slept in her bed with the pots and pans around me so my bed wouldn't get wet when it rained. It seemed like an adventure at the time. Not too bad. But in our town, if you were of that ilk, you were from that side of the tracks, they gave you something called a work paper. You could go to work when you were 13. And so I was given a work paper. And my assignment, you had no choice, my assignment was to work at the Army Recruiting Office. Now, let's just back up one second. 1968, let's see, we'd seen the last of Martin Luther King. We'd seen the last of RFK. There was racial strife, political strife, and there was this invisible strife that was happening behind the doors of the people in my neighborhood. Our parents had proudly marched off to defend democracy in World War II. And they did a marvelous job. They did a marvelous thing, and they came back and they were proud, and they were broken as well. Somehow, they gave birth to a pastel of peaceniks, which really was rather odd. So aside from all the other strife, there was this in-the-house strife. I was 13. I knew what was right. I knew what was wrong. Vietnam was wrong. So here I get this job working at the Army Recruiting Office, where I walked to every day after school. Our town was built around a park, which I might call the square or the green. And I walked through the park and went to the post office, walked up these marvelous marble curved staircase to my office with two recruiting sergeants. I had an actual desk. I was 13. It was one of those gray metal desks with all the drawers. I'd really quite made it. yeah. And I was in this room about the size of a classroom, elementary school classroom, and there were the three desks in there, and there were two sergeants and me, and my job was twofold. I had to go to the draft board every day and pick up the numbers that were going to be released the next day. And this was the Army's attempt at getting their word out first. We are the best. Come with us. Don't get drafted. Don't get thrown on a bus to Fort Dix, New Jersey. We can help you if you come to us. That was half of my job. The other half of my job was just to fold these letters, address them, stamp them, and mail them. And so that's what I did. But after about a week of listening to unspeakable lies that the recruiters told the boys, I felt as though something had to be done. And the lies looked like this. If you had Coke bottle glasses, you could be a fighter pilot. No problem. If you couldn't pass algebra, orthopedic surgeon for you. They had no shame. they picked around until they found out what each boy's dream was. And they were fabulous at teasing out that dream and making it look possible. And boy after boy after boy signed up for the Army because their life could be very exciting, profitable, and wonderful. I thought I'd better do something. So I began to write little notes on the bottom of these recruiting letters. 13. My note said, I didn't have much time, so my note said, do not believe the recruiters, they will lie to you. And there was a peace sign at the end, how I closed it. I probably sent out about 3,000 of these letters. Yeah. One day, I walked through the park, and I was going up this marvelous set of marble steps again, and I encounter Sergeant Fisher on his way down the steps, and he said, go to your office, clean out your desk. Your work is finished here. Don't come back. And I said, okay. How come? And he said, well, one of your letters landed on the desk of a 3-star general. This caused no short amount of, upset within the organization. He said, we also watch you every day walk through the park and you talk to the hippies, and I'd like to know what you are talking to the hippies about. 13. I said, well, we're talking about blowing up the recruiting office. He simultaneously exploded and imploded. He said to me, are you serious? And I said, don't be so gullible, Sergeant Fisher. It wasn't until much later that I found out he did not know the meaning of the word gullible. This was the point at which I turned on my heel and I left the post office and I went to my friend's house. These were adults. They were in their 30s. He was the county prosecutor. She was my friend. They often took me in. And when I walked into the house, she was on the phone. And when she hung up the phone, she immediately dialed her husband and said, you better get home here. Now, my autistic brain, once I said the word gullible, that chapter was done. I forgot all about it. Well, then I get the word that some men in suits are coming to talk to me. And I think, oh my God, it's something to do with pot. So I run upstairs in their split-level house, and I pull out this ancient aspirin, and I flush it down the toilet, and an ancient tissue, and I get rid of that as well, and I figure I've got myself covered. There's no sign of drugs on me anywhere. I'm good. The suits enter the scene and sit in the living room, and their opening gambit was, we understand that your coat was stolen from your locker at high school. I said, it was. It was a nice green downfilled ski park. I liked it. I must have left pot in the pocket. That's all I can think of. Why else would they be interested in my ski parka? Then they said, we have video of you talking to the hippies on the green. 13. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, we're selling guns to the rioters in Newark. At which point the entire room exploded. I was ejected to stand in their living room behind their swinging living room door, the dining room, for about a half an hour, awaiting my fate, still thinking about pot. Eventually, after about a half an hour, I was invited back into the living room and I was arrested and I was charged with planning to bomb a U.S. installation, a post office, threatening the safety of the citizenry, threatening a U.S. military installation, and the ever-popular tinkering with the U.S. mail. Mr. Collister was the county prosecutor, and eventually, after much back and forth, I was released into his recognizance. And I went home that night, something I rarely did, but I went home that night. And when I got up in the morning, my parents were sitting in the living room, sort of stiffly reading their morning newspapers. And my mother folded down her newspaper, looked at me above the fold, and said, you are never going back to work in that recruiting office. Never. I thought, this is pretty good, because I hadn't told them the story. And she said, look at this, look at this. And I look at the headline, and the headline reads, young man, that was me, young man runs into post office screaming, get out, get out, it's about to blow. At which point, I no longer had any faith in anything. The press, the cops, teachers, any institution, it was gone. I lived in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. Most of our neighbors had 5, 6, 7 kids. There were a lot of boys, a lot of girls. Somehow we had a lot more boys. And we had a big time. Jackie Jennings and I had a circus act. I would stand on his shoulders and put my arms out to the side, and he would ride his bike with no hands. And that ended with the cracked skull. But, you know, it was fun while it lasted. And we just had a really big time all the time. I mean, we were just this huge parcel of kids just playing all the time. And then one day I realized that our neighborhood got quiet. It got quieter, and it got quieter, and it became emptier. Jackie Jennings took a sledgehammer to his kneecap because his number had come up. Peter Dugan was shot to death in Vietnam. Timmy Callahan disappeared in the night, never to be heard from again, ever. Well, the speculation was that somebody's dad had taken him to Canada. We knew it wasn't Mr. Callahan because he was the guy who flew two flags every day. So we were pretty sure it wasn't him. And there we were left, this handful of girls, without our circus, without our ever-present football game, without the noise and the racket of our beautiful Irish Catholic neighborhood. And we lined up on that curb, us girls, and we were just quiet, wondering what in the world had happened. We've scuffed our feet in that dirt that always kind of fills up that place between the road and the curb, and we were dragging our toes in that and just wondering what happened. Where were our friends? And I have to ask, can this happen again? Thank you.